From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Labor Department reported today that U.S. employers added 209,000 jobs in July, which is higher than economists expected. The unemployment rate has now fallen to 4.3%, down from 4.4% in June. It's now the lowest in 16 years. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what's behind these numbers today?
Well, I think the short answer is that it's another sign the economy is still humming along pretty nicely and not really showing any signs of overheating. And we saw very low interest rates, near record stock prices, and both of those things have just given companies the confidence to keep hiring.
And this is now something like 82 months of job growth in this country.
That's right. That's right. It's been a long, very good streak.
What were the stronger parts of the economy? What were the weaknesses in this report?
Well, the strength was similar to some of the recent trends we've seen. Restaurants and bars added 53,000 jobs. They've added over 300,000 this year. Professional and business services added 49,000. Healthcare added 39,000 jobs. No sector seems to really be weakening to a degree that's too alarming. But there was little change in some fields such as mining, construction, manufacturing, and finance. But nothing really bleeding jobs too strongly.
What about wages, which have been slow to budge during the entire economic recovery?
Yeah, average hourly earnings were up 2.5%, and that's a little bit better than economists had expected, and it is above the inflation rate, but still not exactly going gangbusters. There was a bright spot in some of the lower-paying sectors. In leisure and hospitality, for example, the annual wage growth was about 3.8%, which is pretty strong, and that's in large part thanks to several states raising their minimum wages last year.
Now, President Trump called the numbers excellent on Twitter, writing, quote, "I have only just begun." But when we saw positive jobs reports under President Obama, Trump called the unemployment rate totally fiction. So now this is something we've been talking about the last few days as the stock market has reached record levels. How much responsibility can the president take for a jobs report?
Right. I guess it's nonfiction numbers now. But
right.
In many ways, the numbers are simply a continuation of the trends we saw during the Obama administration. Remember, the unemployment rate peaked at 10% in 2009 and then fell steadily, reached 4.6% in the month of the election. And the amount of jobs added last month was basically on par with the average we've seen in the 5 years before the election. But that said, it's very true that business confidence surveys showed a huge uptick after the election. So on the margins, I think it is possible that Trump is helping that confidence because of Trump is helping employers add some jobs. But certainly the trends were in place before he got elected.
Well, and he may want to be careful about taking credit, because if there's a bad report, that would mean that he's responsible for that as well.
That's right. They'll back to fiction again, I guess.
What does all of this mean? The stock market hitting records and the jobs report today for the Federal Reserve and its plans to continue raising interest rates this year?
Well, remember, there are two big things the market is expecting of the Fed. The first will actually be a reduction of their balance sheet. In other words, they will slowly stop reinvesting the income they get from the bonds they bought during their stimulus efforts during the recovery from the recession. So that's widely expected to be announced as early as September. And that could likely cause them to push off or postpone increasing interest rates. Right now, the market's pricing in odds of a rate hike in December at about 40%. Hmm. And the needle didn't move too much after the jobs number. But look for that to possibly go higher if the economic numbers continue to come in solidly.
That's Michael Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg News, talking with us about the jobs report today. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And President Trump was also touting a new immigration plan last night at a rally in West Virginia.
For many years, America has issued most of its green cards to lower-skilled immigrants and people that had no hope of getting a job, undermining blue-collar workers and wages, and costing taxpayers billions and billions of dollars a year.
Trump unveiled the details of that proposal this week at the White House with two Republican senators. It would cut in half the number of people allowed to immigrate into the country legally over the next decade, and it would give priority to English-speaking immigrants who are educated and high-skilled. Lance Pritchett is an economist at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. We're going to check out the details of this bill with him. Professor, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with the fundamental premise of this bill, that low-skilled immigrant workers harm American workers and drive down their wages. Is that true?
That's just completely false. We know that that's false through an enormous accumulation of research. And in particular, we have two really good, clear kind of natural experiments of things that happened. One was the Mariel boat lift, where all of a sudden the supply of low-wage workers in the Miami labor market went up by about 28% in the course of 6 months.
This was in the 1980s when many people came from Cuba.
Right. And they didn't come to Miami because it was a particularly hot labor market. They came to Miami because all of a sudden they could get out of Cuba. So it was a clean, natural experiment of people just showing up in a labor market. We have, as economists, have researched that there is zero impact on workers generally, zero impact on high school educated or less workers, and now the latest research shows even zero impact on less than high school educated workers. Basically, you compare Miami to other labor markets in the United States, no difference over the time period from this huge, massive, sudden arrival of immigrants. And let me give you one second example is we actually used to have a temporary low-skill program called the Bracero program back in the 1960s with 500,000 annual workers coming through that program. We eliminated that program. Again, we've done research comparing states that had Bracero workers to states that didn't have Bracero workers. What happened when the Bracero workers disappeared? No impact on agricultural employment, no impact on agriculture worker wages of natives. It just changed technology and changed the composition of things farmers could do. It just does not benefit low-skill workers to eliminate low-skill migrants.
But help me understand the reason why, because the logic would tell you that if there were fewer unskilled workers, that the supply of the labor force would be constricted. Why wouldn't that raise wages for native workers?
Well, because basically look around you. You now go to an ATM. When you go to a retail store, what do? You ring up your own groceries. When it snows in Boston, you know, middle-class people are out there with a piece of machinery called a snowblower shoveling their own walks. Basically, what happens is technology adapts so that you get rid of the low-skill jobs altogether, whereas firms would have hired people for those jobs, they invent machines to do them instead.
Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, who is one of the sponsors of this bill, says the country's immigration system should focus on two goals, and he laid them out at the White House this week.
One, it should help American workers get a decent pay raise and have a higher standard of living. And two, it should help promote economic growth, make America more competitive in the world.
So you have make the point that the first part of that comment doesn't apply, that it would not give American workers a pay raise. But what about that second idea? Isn't it true that bringing well-educated English-speaking immigrants to this country would in fact be good for the economy and make America more competitive?
Absolutely. I am all for America picking up on the best and the brightest from around the world in order to make our society and economy vibrant and diverse and highly productive. I'm all for high-skill migration. But wanting more high-skill migration doesn't mean you need less low-skill migration. And low-skill migration is actually needed in the U.S. economy. The Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out forecasts of job growth. And they forecast that over the next decade, there's going to be 3.6 million additional low-skill non-substitutable jobs, jobs that you really have to be there to do, like cut grass and bus tables and take care of children. These aren't things that we can offshore. These aren't things that are easily mechanized. There's going to be 3.6 million of those low-skilled jobs, and there's only 1.7 million additional workers. So even if every American went to work in these low-skilled jobs, we still couldn't fill all these low-skilled jobs. And when we don't fill these low-skilled jobs, it's not good for the economy. It drives American businesses out from not being able to get the workers they need, and it creates technological shifts that actually in the long run are also bad for American low-skill workers.
Which makes me think that in this bill there is a distinction between giving out green cards, for instance, a path to citizenship, and a guest worker program. This proposed bill is not a guest worker program. Could you envision a system where a more robust guest worker program allows those workers to come into the country to do the jobs that you just described?
I can not only envision such a system, I've written a book called Let Their People Come about exactly that kind of system. We could easily expand the number of workers that we have here temporarily. In fact, a lot of people who want to migrate from poor countries around the world don't want to come and change their residence permanently. They want an opportunity to work in a high productive economy for a period of time. Even during the heyday of American open door policies in the early 20th century, almost half of immigrants who came to the United States went back to their home countries, even when there were no restrictions. So a robust, large-scale system of temporary workers could easily meet the demand for low-skill workers and not have the downsides that giving green cards more on the basis of relationships and family reunification rather than contribution to the economy.
Hmm. Lant Pritchett is a professor of international development at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. Professor Pritchett, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take you to Vermont now to consider another aspect of healthcare. The state has long been a leader of supporting adults with developmental disabilities. It was one of the first states in the country to shut down its institutional hospital and move adults with disabilities out into the community. But now Vermont is grappling with how to continue funding quality services for people with disabilities as they and their caregivers age. Howard Weiss-Tisman from Here and Now contributor Vermont Public Radio reports.
You look fancy today.
It's around 9 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, and Henry Ween's caregivers are changing shifts.
He's good. We went to Brattleboro yesterday.
Okay.
Got some Chinese food.
Nice.
Yeah, he liked it.
Ween is 38 years old. He's got cerebral palsy, and he can't speak, but he likes to play his ukulele.
Yeah.
He lives here in an apartment just 10 miles from his parents, who are in their 70s. The state-supported program provides 24/7 service, but it's expensive, and now the agency is trying to convince the Weens to move their son into an adult foster home. Danielle Alfano is one of Ween's caregivers, and she says Ween deserves to have a place to call his own.
This is where he's happy. He's an adult. He's a man. He needs his own space. He needs his own home. And he does perfectly fine with the way things are. I don't see why there's any reason to change it.
The tension between the local service agency and the Weens highlights some of the challenges Vermont faces as it confronts an increase in the number of adults with developmental disabilities. Between 2004 and 2016, the percentage of adults with disabilities older than 50 who received services jumped about 17%, according to Dale, the Department of Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living. That number is expected to continue to rise.
We do have an aging population in Vermont. For individuals with developmental disabilities, it means that they're aging, and it means that their caregivers tend to be aging as well.
Monica Caserta-Hutt is the commissioner of DALE. She says when Vermont shut down the state institution for people with disabilities in 1993, there was a move to house and care for the former patients out in the community. Caserta-Hutt says there has to be a lot of different supports in place to make sure these adults can live the lives they deserve.
When you're a child, your connections happen at school. You're meant to be making connections and having fun and living your life and learning new things. As an adult, we're having to create that for ourselves and for each other and for folks with disabilities. For adults, it does get more complicated, for sure.
And those complications extend into the funding mechanisms that pay for services for adults. Teresa Earle is Director of Developmental Services at HCRS, which manages the care for Henry Ween. Earle says when the state provides services for an adult, it has to track down funding sources for housing, transportation, job training, and staffing. And the regulations that govern each funding source don't always complement each other.
There's parallel regulations for mental health. There's parallel regulations for Social Security. There's parallel regulations for any place that a person would access any kind of financial support or service will have coexisting regulations that they are responsible to maintain as part of accepting that funding.
In Ween's case, his assisted housing comes with limits on how his Medicaid dollars can be used. As more Vermonters seek individual living arrangements, the state will have to figure out how to make all of the funding pieces work together. It's Friday night at the Ween's house, and Henry's caregiver drove him over for Sabbath dinner. These traditions are important to Henry's family, and his father Sheldon says he's not excited about sending Henry into an adult foster home, where he'd have less control over the food he eats and his health and safety. But it costs about $100,000 a year to provide Henry with the 24/7 paid staff, and that's more than three times what it costs to support an adult to live with a foster family in what the state calls shared living. And while Sheldon Ween understands the dollars and cents that are driving the decision, it's still tough to accept.
I don't think there's a better situation for Henry, not that I could see it, but I think this is a straight, we can cut the costs. I mean, they made the laws, and then they're complaining that the laws they have are forcing the cost of taking care of Henry up so he can't continue.
Vermont remains committed to giving every adult with a developmental disability a chance to live out in the community. But as budgets tighten and the number of those adults increases, it will take some creativity to make all of those pieces fit. For Here and Now, I'm Howard Weiss-Tisman.
Well, CBS executives are on the defense again this week over a lack of diversity in the network's primetime TV shows. This after two lead cast members of the CBS police drama Hawaii Five-0 said they will not be coming back when the show returns for an eighth season next month. Daniel Day Kim and Grace Park quit the show because CBS was paying them less than their white co-stars. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been following this story. Eric, welcome back.
Hi.
Hey, so these two actors say they aren't getting paid fairly. CBS says they were offered unprecedented raises. What's going on?
Well, we TV critics asked CBS exactly that. And Tom Sherman is a senior vice president in charge of programming. And he was challenged because it turns out that everyone in their casting departments on the East and the West Coasts are white people. And a TV critic asked if maybe that was why they were having problems diversifying their cast. Here's what he had to say about that.
Well, they've been together for a long time. That's just how, that's the department that it's been. But we are cognizant of the issue, and we hear you, and we will be looking to expand.
Now, those of us who've been around the TV business for a while know that that's network TV executive speak for we don't really have a good answer.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of pressure along the sense that, you know, they need to do something about this. They need to diversify their own ranks, and they need to figure out how to diversify the cast of their shows.
Well, reporters also asked Sherman why all of the network's primetime shows both last year and this year featured male leads. And Sherman talked about the network's effort to make shows with a female lead last year. And here's how he answered that question.
We had six pilots with female leads, and the way things turned out, those pilots were not felt to be as good as some of the other pilots and series that were picked up, but that had nothing to do with the female leads. They were fantastic. That's just a cycle of business, and that's how it happens sometimes.
Just the cycle of business, Eric. The executive still not willing to say that it's because the leads were women. But it really does nothing to explain some of the deeper issues that are up at play here about why no pilots with women stars would get picked up, does it?
I do think it's kind of a complex issue, but part of it, you wonder what sort of value systems are they using to judge whether or not a show is quote-unquote any good. You know, one of the things that's also interesting is that this is a time when there have never been more really great roles for women on television. You know, we've talked about it on this program before, The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu, Big Little Lies on HBO. So you have to look at CBS and sort of say every other competing outlet is finding ways to showcase women. Why are you guys having a problem?
Well, you mentioned HBO. That they're feeling the heat for a proposed series called Confederate. It's set in a modern America where slavery is still legal. And critics are upset that show, the producers for it, are both white men. What's happening there?
Well, one thing I think is that people don't realize there are two black producers, a husband and wife team, who are also working on the show. And I interviewed them, and, you know, they're trying to make the case that they are going to be very sensitive to the material that they're dealing with. They're basically going to be creating a show that takes place in an alternate future. And in the southern part of the country, there is some form of slavery or racial oppression that still exists. And the, you know, there's a lot of controversy over that because some people don't trust the guys who created Game of Thrones, you know, a show that has had problems with diversity, to really handle this subject sensitively. And other people have kind of said, this seems like an alternate reality that's seen through the lens of, you know, of white people. You know, why couldn't we have an alternate reality where, you know, black people are in charge? And Amazon is developing a series with the producer Will Packer and Aaron Magruder from Boondocks where that exactly happens, where black people get three states in the South as reparations and they form their own country that's doing well. So there's a sense that people want to use an alternate reality format to explore some of these issues. And there's been a really healthy debate about the best way to do it.
But this issue of diversity in TV and in film, clearly it's nothing new. We all remember the Oscars so white hashtag. But do you think that what you just mentioned is an example of the way that things might be getting better for actors, producers of color, and also women?
I think in many areas of television, we're seeing the debate about inclusion really become more sophisticated. And we're saying, if you're going to create a show that's going to really talk about what if slavery survived to the modern day, you know, what would happen? That's why it's so disappointing to see a channel like CBS that seems to kind of stuck in the past. And it's struggling with diversity issues that we saw on network television, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago. Other places like HBO, they're having some really sophisticated questions and discussions about diversity. It's kind of exciting to see, but I certainly understand why people are concerned and paying close attention on all sides of these issues.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks as always.
All right. Always a pleasure.
The Washington Post reported this week that during a conversation with the president of Mexico earlier this year about drugs and gangs, President Trump singled out New Hampshire as, quote, a drug-infested den. That drew sharp criticism from politicians of all stripes in the Granite State and from drug treatment advocates who say the president isn't living up to campaign promises to deal with the state's drug problem. New Hampshire Public Radio's Casey McDermott reports.
Senator Maggie Hassan, a Democrat who oversaw the state's response to the opioid crisis in her previous role as governor, was quick to condemn Trump's characterization. Here she is on CNN.
He should stop insulting people and instead work with us to get the resources to our state and states all around the country who are also challenged by this epidemic.
Republican Governor Chris Sununu also pushed back. He told Boston radio station WRKO that the president should dial back his rhetoric.
It's not constructive and it's not helping. We know the crisis we have here. We're doing great stuff on the ground here. I know he was here in 2016.
Like most candidates running in the New Hampshire primary, Trump did take an interest in learning more about the state's drug crisis. Joe Hannon, a former Republican lawmaker, sat right next to Trump at a roundtable on the issue just weeks before the election. Hannon says he was bothered by Trump's calling his state a drug-infested den, but he is more bothered by inaction and politicization of the issue by politicians from both parties.
He promised we'd sit and talk with us. As a group, the people were there. He said he'd invite us to a very special place, and I assume that was the White House. I'm available for meetings anytime, Mr. President.
That wasn't the only time Trump made sweeping promises to the people of New Hampshire about his plans to help the state in its fight against opioids. Here he was the night he won the primary.
It's a huge problem in New Hampshire. It's a huge problem all over our country. We're going to have borders again, and we're going to work with you people to help you solve that very big problem, and we'll get it done.
But for all of his talk of New Hampshire's heroin problems on the campaign trail, drug prevention advocates say Trump hasn't given the state as much attention since taking office. No one from the state has a seat on a White House commission the administration launched to address the issue earlier this year. And advocates say they're still waiting for those follow-up calls Trump promised as a candidate.
We have not heard, and we have offered, to support the Trump administration in efforts to address this problem.
Linda Saunders-Paquette is the president of New Futures, one of the state's largest drug prevention advocacy groups.
New Hampshire should play a more prominent role because we have important experiences to share. Experiences, I think, that can inform federal policy when it comes to addressing this crisis.
Recovery advocate Chris Blevins, who worked with Trump and other candidates on the campaign, said she might not agree with the president's choice of words, but his sentiment is spot on.
What he's saying is true. You know, we are in the midst of a very serious epidemic that demands a state of emergency because people are dying left and right on a daily basis.
A makeup artist based in Manchester and registered independent, Blevins threw herself into fighting the state's opioid crisis after losing her stepdaughter, Amber, to a heroin overdose in 2014. That included educating candidates, including Trump, who sat in her makeup chair, about the crisis during the campaign.
We're all sitting here ready to serve and ready to be called upon.
In 2016, a record 486 people died from drug overdoses in New Hampshire. They're still counting this year, but officials expect the problem to continue. For Here and Now, I'm Casey McDermott.
The Pentagon is still awaiting official orders from President Trump after he tweeted last week that transgender people will not be allowed to serve in the military. The president says the military cannot afford the medical costs and the disruption to unit cohesion. The transgender community is vowing to fight back, including Dr. Christine McGinn. She's a transgender woman and a plastic surgeon who specializes in gender reassignment surgery at the Papillon Center in Pennsylvania. She's also a former Navy flight surgeon. Dr. McGinn, welcome. And in light of all of this, you are offering free surgery to transgender service members. Why?
Well, I'm just offering to help active duty service members, because I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal. I don't think there's going to be that many people. And as long as I'm able to help out, I have no problem doing that, because these service members deserve care. This isn't a social engineering experiment. This is evidence-based medicine. And, you know, I'm a physician, and I just feel like, you know, there aren't a whole lot of people that do what I do, and I have no problem taking care of our own.
Well, let's get to the cost of that surgery then, because that's the fundamental part of what the president is saying is wrong with having transgender troops in the military. How much does one of these reassignment or confirmation surgeries, as they're also called, cost?
Well, there are different ways to talk about this. The RAND study has studied this issue in the military and is quoting $2.4 to $8.4 million per year. And that is in stark contrast to the $49 billion that it costs for healthcare for all military members. When you ask me that question, you know, one surgery in the civilian world isn't the same as the cost of a surgery in the military world, because you're performing the surgery in-house, or you could possibly perform the surgery in-house. And that's the other thing that, you know, I would be willing to do, is to train military surgeons to be able to perform this. And so the cost is, you know, not the same as it would be on the outside. But since you asked the question, the cost of the surgery varies from where you are, what state you're in. But you're asking me the cost of the surgery. Well, you have to remember that there are several different surgeries we're talking about. So this is a difficult question to answer. But I think what you're getting at is how much is a vaginoplasty. So a vaginoplasty is $21,500 for the entire cost of it. So that includes pre-op care, post-operative care, the hospital stay, the anesthesia stay, the surgical fee, the whole 6 months or so treatment of follow-up.
So do the math there then. The estimate from RAND is that between 2,000 and 11,000 service members are transgender. It could be as high as 15,000. It's hard to know. Some of those are your patients. How have they responded to the president's announcement?
Well, I think going back to the RAND study, that they are estimating between 25 and 130 service members per year would be in a position where they were requiring surgery. So not every service member needs surgery. You know, some of them have had surgery, some of them don't want surgery, and some of them won't need surgery for a year or two. So again, the numbers are confusing.
And the patients that you have who are active members of the military, when you talk to them about this, what are they telling you about how they're feeling now?
They're telling me that it's not a big deal. I mean, their command is accepting of them. They have been part of a unit for a very long time. And, you know, I've been asking people, because I'm curious as well, as how's this going? And from a command level, it hasn't been an issue. President Obama studied this and created a whole policy around it, and it has been working fine. People have been having access to therapy and to hormones, and the last piece of it was the surgical part. And from what I understand, since this came into effect about a year ago, it takes a year to ramp up to the point where somebody would need surgery. So where we are now, that's exactly where we are. And the timing of this tweet is exactly when people were about to have surgery. So they feel like they had the rug pulled out from under them, and they're not sure what they're going to do. And they're getting mixed messages between their command and the military. And, you know, then you get this tweet from the top and without any specifics. So it creates a tremendous amount of stress and a blow to morale, for sure.
And it's already got to be a stressful situation, right? I mean, having a reassignment or a confirmation surgery is an emotional thing to go through, I imagine. Does it add any complexity when the patient is in the military?
Well, yes, because I think there's a tremendous... I mean, look at the history of the way military has treated LGBT folks. I mean, and just now, I think we were just making progress with the ridiculousness of don't ask, don't tell, and people feeling okay to just be themselves, which I would think would make them a better service member because they're not preoccupied. So obviously, yes, definitely. And if you add to it the things maybe people don't really think about, like what if somebody was serving for 18 or 19 years and was getting ready to retire, and the government says it's okay to you know, seek treatment for being transgender, and then as a result of that, you will now be kicked out and lose your retirement, which is, you know, we don't know how this is all going to fall out, but, you know, we're leaving these folks hanging.
Right. Well, the bigger point that the critics will point to is that the military and the United States government should not be the ones who are responsible for paying for these treatments, these therapies. Could you make the argument the other direction for why the United States government should be responsible for it?
Well, we should never be in the business of refusing medical care for our service members. It's very simple. I don't think there is an opposite argument. You know, this isn't, I think people have the wrong, they have this idea of Corporal Klinger and MASH or something, somebody walking around, you know, these are people who have been performing their duties for their whole career. And this is a medical issue. This isn't a choice, and this isn't a social experiment. It's a medical issue. And that's recognized. We have consensus in the medical community on that.
The Family Research Council, it's a conservative group that is very much in favor of the president's announcement, says that the economic cost, what hasn't been taken into account, is the lost time that it takes to recover from one of these surgeries. And that, they say that could add up to billions of dollars over the course of a decade. What do you say to that?
Well, again, I go back to, you know, many service members aren't going to have surgery. Many, you know, I told you the number was between 25 and 130. I offered to do, you know, free surgery a week ago. We've only had 15 requests so far. So, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. This is not burdensome. It's a drop in the bucket compared to what we're spending on trips to Mar-a-Lago and security at Trump Towers and all these other superfluous things.
Well, and there's also critics within the military. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs said that he will wait for an official order from the president before making any changes to current policy. In other words, he's not going to respond to a tweet. This week, 56 retired generals and admirals publicly opposed the president's decision. Do you think that there's a chance that this is all a bluff, that this will not happen?
Well, what the military is defending is equal rights and freedom, and this is blatant discrimination. Why would you send a tweet that doesn't allow, you know, a service member even answer the phone who, you know, who's transgender? What if somebody, if your argument is cost or readiness, and somebody isn't having any surgery, and they're not going to be, you know, they will be deployable because they're not having surgery, and they're just coming and saying they're transgender, why would you have a blanket statement that you're going to get rid of all of them out of the whole military? That's indefensible.
Look, I know you don't want to have your offer to provide these surgeries for free put you at the center of this story, but you left the military in 2000, and this was before you or others could serve openly. All this is just, it's got to be personal for you, isn't it?
No, it's based on compassion for people. I mean, that's the bottom line. You know, this isn't spite. This is, well, maybe this is reaching across the aisle. Maybe, you know, I'm serious about it. This isn't done out of spite. Like, what if the military takes a look at what I do after a year and I make this offer and they say, wow, that wasn't a big deal. And these people are back and they're finished their surgery and they're working and they had a month or two downtime, and here we are, and it wasn't the big brouhaha that everybody thought it was going to be. And maybe that'll open some doors for them to, you know, consider.
Dr. Christine McGinn, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for the story.
The World War II drama Dunkirk has been a surprise summer hit at the box office, taking in more than $265 million worldwide since it opened 2 weeks ago. The film is getting attention for its stunning visuals. It was shot mostly on super high-resolution IMAX cameras, and some theaters around the country are projecting it on 70mm film. 70mm is larger format than typical 35mm film, theoretically making the film more true to life. But is it really all it's cracked up to be? Let's ask Wesley Morris, critic at large for the New York Times. Hi, Wesley.
Hello, Jeremy.
So I saw Dunkirk in 70mm, and I didn't notice any difference. Am I wrong there? Is it really that much better?
I think that it is better. It is definitely better for a Christopher Nolan movie. I'd say there may be 10 directors on the whole planet who, if they shot a movie in 70mm, I'd tell you have to see it the way they did it. And Christopher Nolan is definitely in like the top three. 70mm, it just looks great. It's clearer. You can see things that with a clarity that you wouldn't be able to see them in a digital format.
But let me just push back on that for a second.
Sure.
Because these days, the way that you see movies in general, even if it's not 70mm, it's so crisp and clear and so much better than it used to be, isn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, what we're really talking about is not really which format is better. What we're really talking about is which movie theater you are watching this format in. And it really is going to come down to how competently projected and exhibited these movies are. You know, the first time I saw Dunkirk, I could still see the edges of the frame of like the, it was like letterboxed for me, which is not how you want to watch a movie, but is how most of us watch our movies now, because there's no scrim or there's no curtain to keep that letterboxing from showing up on the screen.
Well, several major releases in recent years have made a big deal about their 70mm releases. Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. Why is this trend happening now and people are releasing it in this way?
Because it's better than 3D. Remember when everything was in 3D?
Right.
This is these are great filmmakers trying to bring a format back that was a special event format when like Lawrence of Arabia came out, for instance, in the 60s. And I think it for certain filmmakers, I think it gives them a challenge in a way. I mean, The Hateful Eight, I don't think, quote, needed to be shot, unquote, in 70mm. But the challenge for Tarantino there was to try to make one interior space seem cinematic in a way that it might not have had he shot it in 35 or with like his iPhone.
Now, when you said a moment ago that remember when everything was in 3D, does that mean 3D's done?
Oh, God, I hope so. I mean, you still have to watch some. Well, I watched War for the Planet of the Apes in 3D, and it was fine, actually. It was a smart use of that technology. But far, far fewer movies you have to suffer through in 3D now than you did before. But that also means that some of the theaters that paid all that money for that technology to exhibit 3D still have those cameras that should not be showing non-3D movies. So you get this sort of darkened picture around the frame. Like, it cheapens your movie-going experience, even if you're just seeing Minions or Despicable Me 3 or whatever.
Poor Minions. The next thing I want to talk to you about is the music in Dunkirk. And I'm going to actually start playing it right now. And we're going to do what they do in the movie, which is to play it for the rest of our conversation. Because it literally lasts for the whole thing. Yeah, yeah. Bring it up, Mike. Let's hear some of this menacing, intense music from Dunkirk. Did you think that it was a bit much, Wesley Morris, that they played it through the whole thing? Do we really need this to make it more intense than it already was?
Well, you know what? I was thinking about this while I was watching it and wondering if you're Christopher Nolan, what the deal is you strike with your composer under these circumstances and whether or not it really does help. See, I'm already not liking this movie right now. Whatever right. movie we're in, I don't want to watch
it's
that
It's getting
anymore.
Too intense. Enough with this. Right.
But here's what I would say. For the most part, nobody's talking when the music's on. There's very little dialogue in this movie. And when there is dialogue, one of the downsides with 70mm is the sound mix, while as great as it is not great for dialogue. So there are entire sequences where the pilots are talking, where Tom Hardy is talking and trying to like figure out how to shoot these other right. warplanes. I did not know what they were saying. So it's not great for dialogue, as our audience is discovering right now, probably.
Well, and do you think this is going to be a Best Picture nominee? Because people are calling it brilliant.
Of course it's going to be a Best Picture nominee. I can't imagine why it wouldn't be. Christopher Nolan is exactly what all those, like, old Hollywood people want. They want him to make a movie that they understand, that they don't need a diagram to figure out. They don't want Inception. They want this. And I think Christopher Nolan wants this. I don't think he's good at science fiction, to be honest with you. I think he, as it turns out, is very good at making something that could have been made in 1942.
Do you feel like something really bad is about to happen?
Yeah, like this segment going on for two more minutes.
Wesley Morris, critic at large for the New York Times, talking with us about Dunkirk. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jeremy.